The following was recorded at the Hadassah's 70th Annual Convention, held September 26th through 29th, 1984, in San Francisco.
It is 9 o'clock. This is the last formal session before the luncheon, and really almost the closing session of this convention. And I think it is particularly fitting that we close with a problem, and one with which we hope to have some solutions. I'm going to introduce the dais to you in just a moment after I kill about another minute, because this is almost the last time that Frieda will be here as the president. Our president-elect is sitting in the front row. I know you would want to show her your appreciation for the fact that she's here and on time. And now let me introduce those who are on the dais. I think we're setting another record here this morning. This is probably the smallest dais at this convention. And if Hadassah is not going to be known for anything else, and of course it will be known as the organization with the longest and most beautiful daises in the organized world. Occasionally, those daises are brightened by handsome males. And I want also to pay tribute to the gentlemen who are in the audience, because they're not used to this late night business and all the partying, and I appreciate the fact that so many of them are here. To my right is Carmela Kalmanson, newly elected National Vice President and Zionist Affairs Chairman for Hadassah. I am not going to introduce the gentleman at this moment. All of you know that he's Rabbi Mark Tannenbaum, but I will give him a more formal introduction in a moment. To my left is Barbara Goldstein, National Chairman of Jewish Education. Barbara. And Eleanor Barrett, who is the National American Affairs Committee Chairman. I am Rose Matzkin, your chairman for this morning. Do better than that. This is called an interfaith dialogue. And it might seem almost a peculiar title since we are talking to ourselves. I don't think there's any interfaith here, because I refuse to believe that Reform, Conservatism, Reconstructionism, and Orthodox are different faiths. They are all facets of one. And since we did have a very full and interesting lecture on the ethos and the beliefs and the habits of the Muslim world, nevertheless, I don't think anybody here is part of the Muslim faith. So that our interfaith dialogue usually concerns itself with Christianity, one of the great religions of the world, and one with which we are all too familiar. Although many of us, coming from big cities where there are large Jewish populations, can go through life almost untouched by the non-Jewish world outside. Those of us who live in smaller communities very often do not socialize with non-Jews, and therefore are in need of knowing why and how an interfaith dialogue is and can be and should be of the utmost importance to us, since we live in an age where such dialogue is possible. A wise man said once that destiny aids and helps along those who recognize her. The blind she drags. We have recognized destiny, and we know that we are living in a time and during a time and in a place when the opportunities for solving some of the problems which religion in its worst form has exacerbated through the ages. There was a time when Jews dared hardly address a non-Jew, certainly had nothing to do with him face to face, and lived in as narrow and bigoted a world, if I'm stealing anything from you, Rabbi, stop me, that it is possible to imagine. The Jewish problem, as all of us are only too well aware, is really a Christian problem. We don't have problems with our Jewishness. The very fact that all of you are at this convention and think of the subjects which we have covered in this decade of days is really a remarkable manifestation of the fact that we recognize that destiny has made it possible for us to be here, to recognize, and to grapple with the problems which face us. For a few minutes yesterday, I watched television, and I listened to Jerry Falwell, and I listened to Father Drinan, two extremes who were discussing the problems of schools, of release time, of the various candidates about whom we do not speak in terms of those for whom we are in favor and of those for whom we will not vote. But it is interesting to observe that both of them, in their attack on Louis Farrakhan and in their attack on certain ideas and ideas which are being promulgated, made the Middle East and the Jewish citizenry of the United States their principal subjects in the discussion. We are a small people which has had such an enormous, tremendous impact upon the history of the world that sometimes each one of us must wonder why, since we are such a great people who have given the theory, the belief, the faith in the one God to the world, which has seen it adopted by other religions, should nevertheless be the target of so much that has been evil, even in the most exquisite of religious tenets and beliefs. It is therefore, I think, a very fitting last session at this convention that we should have with us one who has been in the forefront of this interfaith dialogue and Christian-Jewish relations. The name of Rabbi Mark Tannenbaum is known to all of you. I told him that I am not given to long and fulsome introductions, and he said he would prefer to have the time for his own speaking and for the questions which will follow. However, I once did one of the most popular things of my public career. I eliminated my own speech and my own introduction of the speaker from a program in Washington many years ago. It was so well received that I have never, ever done anything like that again. And so I will not skip just the few things I want to say about Rabbi Tannenbaum. He is the Director of International Relations of the American Jewish Committee and has a long and distinguished career in international human rights, world refugee problems, world hunger problems, and foreign relations concerns. He was formerly the National Interreligious Affairs Director and was designated in a recent national poll as one of the 10 most influential and respected religious leaders in America. A cover story in New York Magazine has described Dr. Tannenbaum as the foremost Jewish ecumenical leader in the world today. Dr. Tannenbaum was invited by President Jimmy Carter as the American Jewish leader among 10 national religious and academic spokesmen to discuss the state of the nation at Camp David summit meetings in 1979. And he is a member of the advisory committee of the President's Commission on the Holocaust. Dr. Tannenbaum is a founder and leading member of the Joint Liaison Committee of the Vatican Secretariat on Catholic-Jewish Relations and the International Jewish Committee for Interreligious Consultations and a similar body in the World Council of Churches. He served as consultant to the NBC TV 9-hour special, Holocaust, and earlier was consultant to the special, Jesus of Nazareth. He has lectured at major universities, seminaries, religious and educational bodies in the United States, Europe, and Israel, and at numerous national and international conferences. He's the author or editor of several published books and of numerous articles. And despite all of this, Rabbi, I think I am safe in saying that nowhere will you have found a more interested, a more informed, or an audience more eager to hear what you have to tell us. Rabbi Kahn.
If that was the walkie-talkie of a physician, it may be very reassuring to know that there is a doctor in the house. That was one of the most spectacular introductions, setting of the stage for a discussion, and one of the most graceful, sophisticated formulations of the issues that I've heard on any platform. And I want to tell Mrs. Matzkin how much I not only appreciate that, but how much I deeply needed that kind of confirmation which she just gave to me. I've literally come here just after a few days of having spent two grueling weeks in travel in South America, in Brazil, Argentina, and Uruguay, where I had the privilege of meeting this past week with President Alfonsín, the new hope of democratic reform in Latin America, and with his foreign minister, Dante Caputo, with whom it is critical to discuss the role of Latin American countries, particularly Argentina, Brazil, Chile, and others in the United Nations, in a major effort we have undertaken to begin to mobilize nations around the world to get off their obscene duffs when Israel and Jews are being attacked in the most anti-Semitic ways and anti-Israel ways at the United Nations. But my point in telling you that going through schedules which have involved starting off with breakfast meetings at 8 o'clock in the morning and some strange tribal custom of starting dinner in Latin America at 10 o'clock at night, it does something to your kishkes. So I need all the consolation I can get and reinforcement, and I feel that this whole setting of being at home in this great mishpacha of Hadassah gives me that kind of neshama yetera, that extra soul which I so desperately need. Mrs. Matzkin, I think quite rightly, confined herself to the subject at issue and didn't want to waste much time, nor do I, but I cannot begin this presentation to you this morning without acknowledging the profound sense of appreciation that I have had throughout my entire life for the role, the model, the inspiration, the dedication that Hadassah has given to the Jewish people, to Israel, to Soviet Jewry, and Jews throughout the world. And I've come here really to say thank you for all the extraordinary contributions you've made to Jewish life. I'm a native of Baltimore, Maryland, and so my bonds go back at least to Henrietta Zold, whom I didn't know, but whom I knew as a legend in Baltimore. And beyond that, one of your former presidents bears my mishpacha name, Bernice Tannenbaum, and I have had the privilege of being associated, not as closely often as I would have liked to, but frequently enough to know of the extraordinary leadership that Charlotte Jacobson has given in the President's Conference of the World Zionist Organization, and She is really responsible for my being here today, and I'm indebted to her for the privilege of that invitation. When I was a child growing up in an Orthodox Jewish home in Baltimore, we used to sit around on a Shabbos afternoon at home, and I recall once on a Saturday afternoon sitting with my mother and father, and we began talking about Jewish witzen, you know, Jewish soul, Jewish psyche, Jewish humor. And I recall turning to my mother, Alea Shalom, and asking her, well, what's Jewish humor? What is so distinctive about Jewish humor? Tell me what a Jewish joke is. And my mother turned to me in a rather wry way, and she said, well, my son, I'll tell you what a Jewish pleasure is. A Jewish pleasure is a cool Yom Kippur. And that's the sense which I should like to suggest represents a realistic grasp of the importance of the issue that we are now about to examine together. A grasp that does not swing between fantasy, illusion, pessimism or utopia at the other end, but an effort to come to terms with a profound human, social, political reality which Jews cannot afford to understand with precision and cup. Let me begin at the outset with something that Rose Matzkin suggested to you today. If we begin looking at the issue of Jewish-Christian relationships from what is a traditional way of looking at it, we will assure ourselves that we will not leave this room with any more insider information than we came into it. Namely, if we begin looking at the question of our relationships with the Christian world and say, the Christians think, the Christians believe, the Christians do, we will be guilty of the same genetic fallacy, as philosophers would call it, as when Christians say, the Jews own all the banks, the Jews do this, the Jews killed Christ. It begins with those kinds of sweeping generalizations. And so the first point of departure, if we come away with nothing else, is to begin to understand the complexity and the diversity of the world which we talk about when we talk about our relationships with the Christian world in the Jewish-Christian dialogue and Jewish-Christian network. So let me just take a few moments to do the topography, the lay of the land of what we're talking about. In the United States alone, in terms of the diversity of the Christian world, there are an estimated 50 million Roman Catholics in this country. And interestingly, the greatest concentration of Jewish population in the United States in major urban industrial centers is side by side with those of the major concentrations of Roman Catholics in the United States. So that in many communities in our major urban centers, when one talks about Jewish-Christian relationships, one is talking very heavily about Catholic-Jewish relationships. Then there are the mainline liberal Protestants in this country, of whom there are an estimated some 45 to 50 million as well. Most of the major Protestant denominations, the Baptists, the Lutherans, the Episcopalians, the American Baptists, are affiliated with the National Council of Churches, about which I will have something to say in a few moments. Beyond that, there are some 6 million Greek Orthodox in the United States, who somewhat like the Jews, while small in numbers, are fiscally and politically potent, and with whom we have begun a relationship that I want to refer to a little bit along the way because they have very serious implications for relationships in the Middle East for Israel and her Arab neighbors. And finally, there is the group of Christians with whom we began the most recent set of relationships, beginning in the late 1960s and early 1970s, the evangelical Christians in the United States. And they number today something like 50 million people in this country. They are the fastest growing churches in the United States. While liberal Protestants have gone through a period of significant decline, loss of membership, loss of income from their members, the evangelical Christians, who are, as we know, heavily conversionary, missionary, enterprising, proselytizing, are growing faster than any other Christian body in this country. It is no accident that Dr. Billy Graham, whom I want to say something about in a few moments, who happens to be a very deep friend of the Jewish people and of Israel, and of Soviet Jews, and of the cause of standing against anti-Semitism, which I will come to in a few moments. Evangelical Christians are believed to convert every Sunday morning an average of 8,000 Americans to the Southern Baptist churches alone. In fact, one of my friends in the Southern Baptist Convention said to me, "You know, sometimes I think we have more Baptists than we have people." Now, in that diversity, it is also important to keep in mind that there are other kinds of cross-cutting influences in understanding what is going on in each of those major religious communities. There are, first of all, in every community, Roman Catholic, mainline Protestant, evangelical Christian, even Greek Orthodox, a broad diversity of ideological and political views, from liberal to conservative, even from radical to radical right. And therefore, as one approaches each of those communities, one must do so with some careful analysis of with whom in those communities one is relating to. Liberal Protestants, conservative Protestants, liberal Catholics, traditional Catholics, and what are their agenda as they impact on Jews and on America. First principle, then, is that of the diversity and the pluralism in each of those communities. The second major principle, which is an operating principle in terms of how we relate to these communities in terms of our agenda, is that we ought not get ourselves into the bind, which I believe some of us do, even our leadership from time to time, that somehow we are involved in a kind of either major romance where one marries a Christian community and one wants a total love affair with total commitment on everything, and we've got to get upon them. Ice relationship, total marriage or divorce. And that has to do not only in terms of the Christian world, it has to do with ethnics, it has to do with race, it has to do with our own personal lives. I want to establish simply and quickly, there is a very deep literature in social science which deals with a way in which Americans realize their purposes in American life, and it is summarized in the term selective participation. In the diversity of American life, no single American realizes all of his or her purposes in any one institution anymore. There was a time in the early history of America where Christians in the Massachusetts Bay Colony, the 17th century and later, realized all of their life purposes in the life of the church. And Roman Catholics did so as well. Jews did so as well in the synagogue. You went to the synagogue, it was the Beis HaKnesses, it was the Beis HaTefillah, it was a place you went to study, to learn, your whole social life was there. In the diversity of America and the pluralism of America, the segmentation of our lives, which has raised all other kinds of problems, we realize different purposes and relationships to different institutions. So that some people join the Rotary Club, and some join the Lions, and some join the Masons, and some join the Chamber of Commerce, in each way realizing some other aspect of their life's needs. Now, the only organization that defies that is Hadassah. And Hadassah, the cooler boy, get involved in that, and everything is in there. And I see that in some dedication, which is magnificent to see. It is a traditional form of commitment. But in much of the segmented life of America, there is selective participation. And what I want to suggest as a matter of policy and approach, at least one which I follow, is that in every relationship to every community, one deals selectively with Roman Catholics. There are certain things that one can do with Roman Catholics in terms of coalition and joint relationship. There are other things where we simply are not going to have that kind of relationship. Thus, for example, every community has its own agenda. Now, Jews sometimes become defensive. They say that Christians and those who are not exactly friendly to us or people in the society generally, all Jews care about are Jewish issues. All they care about is Israel, Soviet Jewry, anti-Semitism. They don't care about anybody else or anything else. In some cases, that may be too, an extremist. But let me tell you something. It is a kind of dirty, ugly secret of America. The Roman Catholics have a Catholic agenda. And don't feel ashamed about it. It is abortion. It is eight parochial schools. It is some aspects of church-state relationships. There's a Catholic agenda with which Catholics come to the dialogue table. Mainline Protestants, who think of themselves as universalists, they have a mainline Protestant agenda. And the mainline Protestant agenda primarily has to do with race relations, because the problem of black-white relationships is essentially taking place in the mainline Protestant community. Because of the 23 million blacks in the United States, 17 million of them are Protestants. And they have been working out the problems of race relations in the mainline Protestant denomination. And Protestants come to the table with the issue of race relations, which is one of their agenda items. They also come with other third world issues, their relationships with South Africa, Africa, Asia, etc. That, while it sounds universalist, it is a very particular Protestant agenda, and the evangelicals have an agenda of their own, too. The evangelical agenda is to try to save America by prayers in the public schools. Free access for religious classes and proselytizing, that's what that's about, in the public school system. And then other issues, abortion, anti-ERA, those kinds of questions. And Jews come to the table quite legitimately and unashamedly with a Jewish agenda of a concern for the fate and welfare of 3 million of our brothers and sisters in Israel, 3 million Jews in the Soviet Union who are suffering oppression and harassment as no other community in the Soviet Union, plus the problems of anti-Semitism which we face in new forms now with anti-Zionism and the PLO and the Soviet Union and the United Nations. But having said that, coming clearly with that awareness that every group in the pluralism of America comes with on its agenda, at the same time has a responsibility for the common welfare, which is what pluralism ultimately is about, as I shall come to at the end of my remarks, let's take a look now at our agenda and its relationship with the Christian world. These items on the Jewish agenda of Israel, the support and welfare of Israel, the support and welfare of 3 million Jewish men, women, and children in the Soviet Union, and their human rights and their right to leave, and the problems of anti-Semitism in the United States, Western Europe, Latin America, and elsewhere, how are we faring in relationship to the Christian world today? Next year, October 1985 to be exact, will mark the 20th anniversary of the adoption by Vatican Council II of the Vatican Declaration Nostra Aetate, Latin for in our time, as the words begin of the declaration. It is the Vatican Declaration on Catholic-Jewish relations. I know something about that declaration. I spent a good part of 3 years of my life in Rome with one of my colleagues, Zachariah Schuster, battling against some of the most reactionary elements in the Catholic Church and a coalition of Arabs and Muslims who tried to destroy that declaration. That declaration was promulgated after 3 years of intensive debate. And as Ms. Matzkin rightly said, quite remarkably, one of the central issues of the Vatican Council, 2,500 cardinals, bishops, archbishops from all over the world assembled together in Rome to deal with the problems of the world, and one of the central major issues is the question of the relationship of the Catholic Church to the Jewish people, and clearly for good reason. That Vatican Declaration was, I can tell you from my own personal experience and observation, the greatest course in Catholic-Jewish relations in the history of anti-Semitism ever given in 1900 years of Christian history. To sit in St. Peter's Basilica and see cardinals and bishops and archbishops and Pariti experts from all over the world, Asia, Africa, Latin America, the Western Europe, even Eastern European countries, sitting and hearing experts talk about Hatasi. 1900 years of anti-Semitism in which the Christian world played such a central role in the teaching of contempt. And as the late blessed Pope John the 23rd declared, it is no longer permissible for the Catholic Church to regard itself as a church which preaches the gospel of love and in fact become the gospel of hatred to the people from which the church owes everything. And Pope John the 23rd used to say to us, we owe everything to you. Jesus was Jewish, the Virgin Mary was Jewish, the disciples were Jewish. The Bible is your book. Even the New Testament, only two books of the New Testament was not written by Jews. Everything we owe to the Jews. The vision of God, the vision of the dignity of man, the vision of social responsibility and social justice, the product of... And we're not doing this as a favor to you. We're doing it for our own self-purification. And they carried out that process, the beginning of that process of self-purification. And Vatican Council Declaration was promulgated on October the 28th, 1965, Pope Paul VI, for the entire Catholic world. 800 million Roman Catholics throughout the world were given a new set of marching orders. The first time in 1900 years of history that the entire Roman Catholic Church faced frontally the question of Christian responsibility. For the Christ killer charge, for the notion of the wandering Jew, that Jews wander to the end of time as punishment by God because they did not accept Jesus as the Messiah, and all of those other lovely teachings of love. And the Vatican Council, my friends, I can tell you, as a result of that proclamation, as a result of the fact that in 1974, after we had set up a joint commission with the Vatican, issued a set of guidelines which became specific instructions in Mamelashen. It's not enough general principles that this church affirms its common patrimony with the Jewish people to whom we sow so much. It must have tachlis, and this is what we put to the Vatican. These general principles are found, but our Vatican Declaration will end up as one of 12 million books in the Vatican Library unless it becomes real. And specific instructions were given in the Vatican guidelines, change textbooks, remove the Christ killer charge, tell the truth about the Jews as they are, as a living people today, not as some footstool who are to be removed from history with the coming of Christianity. And over the period of the past 20 years, I can tell you, as a result of work that we and others have done in relationship to the Catholic Church, we have made greater progress in overcoming anti-Semitism, negative images toward Jews, Judaism, an understanding of the Holocaust, the beginning of an understanding of the profound moral, spiritual, and historic bonds between Jews and Israel, greater progress in understanding of those fundamental issues between the Roman Catholic Church and the Jewish people during the past two decades than at any time in the past 1900 years. And that is no exaggeration. I have a woman who works for us in our office who does nothing but read Catholic textbooks at their request of their publishers to make sure that they say nothing that is unacceptable to the Jews. Today, I can tell you that if you go into any Catholic parochial school in this city, in the United States, you will not find a single Catholic textbook used in elementary schools and secondary schools which have a single anti-Semitic reference anymore. And you compare that to the... And you compare that to the Baltimore Catechism of 1937, my hometown. The Baltimore Catechism, which was the basic textbook for raising a whole generation of Catholics, begins, tell why the Jews were rejected by God. Why did the Jews suffer so much? Why did they bring so much pride? And children were raised on that. So you see the demonology. What has now begun to take place is nothing less than a revolution which one of my friends, a Catholic priest in Rome, the president of a pontifical university who came in to see me again just several weeks ago, said, Vatican Council II has become a revolution in mutual esteem. Give you some sense of what that means and why it is of significance to us today. A survey was recently done by a permanent official of the Catholic hierarchy in the United States who has one job. He was set up after Vatican Council II, after Father Flannery would have the position, to do nothing but to devote himself to moving in the Catholic churches on every level, clergy, laity, nuns, adults, youth, to face the sources of anti-Jewish attitudes and to teach the new teachings of a theology of Judaism that appreciates Judaism in its own terms, not as candidates for conversion. And a survey was done by the National Association of Diocesan Ecumenical Officers, of all of the ecumenical officers in the Catholic Church around the country, including the city, asking them how they respond to these new teachings of the Church which came out of Vatican Council II and have since been developed. And they found these questions. Do you believe that Judaism still plays a unique role in God's plan of salvation? 92% of the ecumenical officers in every community of the United States said yes. They were asked, do you believe that the Jewish covenant of God has never been revoked by God? The Jews remain the people of God? 85% of them said yes. Some had difficulty with two covenant theories of theological subtlety. And Dr. Eugene Fisher, who made the survey public, said, if you had taken that survey 20 years ago, it would have been exactly the reverse, exactly the opposite in much of the Catholic community today. I was just in Brazil, as I mentioned to you. Brazil is 93% Roman Catholic. No government in Brazil can last unless it has a positive relationship with the Roman Catholic hierarchy of the National Conference of Catholic Bishops. In every city I went to, I met with a cardinal in Rio de Janeiro, Cardinal Salles. I was greeted with a kind of reception that was almost embarrassing. At one point, he almost referred to me as Bishop Tannenbaum. I said, I'm... I turned to him, I said, I'm not settling for anything less than a cardinal, and I brought my red yarmulke with me. Well, we ended up resolving that by saying that the reason I never became a bishop is because I was not unfrocked, I was just unsuited. The National Conference of Catholic Bishops of Brazil adopted a long statement. I won't read all of it. In this overwhelmingly Catholic country, saying the following, it is the official teaching of the Catholics of Brazil. After 20 centuries of coexistence, which were given a particular hallmark by the events in Europe, which preceded and accompanied the Second World War, a new awareness of the origins and history of both Judaism and Christianity demonstrates the need for reconciliation between Jews and Christians. This reconciliation must take the form of dialogue inspired by a healthy desire for knowledge of one another, together with mutual understanding. It is indispensable for dialogue that Catholics should strive to learn by what essential traits the Jews define themselves, that is to say, as a people clearly defined by religious and ethnic elements. The first constitutive element of the Jewish people is its religion, which in no way authorizes Catholics to envisage them as if they were simply one of the many religions of the world today. It was, in fact, through the Jewish people that faith in the one true God, that is to say, monotheism, has entered into human history. And then it has a section about acknowledging the deep bonds of the relationship between the Jews and the land of Israel. This has happened now in every country in Europe. In West Germany, East Germany is yet to follow. France, Italy, Spain, throughout the whole of Europe, now every country in Latin America has adopted positions like this of respect and indebtedness of Christians to Jews and Judaism. So some Jews say, so what? I'll tell you so what. Read the speech of Louis Farrakhan about the Jews no longer being the people of God, that the synagogue is a synagogue of Satan, that the state of Israel is a criminal act, the result of lying and cheating, and the kind of attention that gets to the point. It was not enough that the obscenity was once said. It has to be given the megaphone to the world of the National Press Club. With the president of the National Press Club finding... Yeah, he would invite Adolf Hitler too, he said. That's something about the moral sensibility of that world in which we live, and that is why today the Catholic Church and many liberal Protestant people in the pews and evangelical Christians who have this profound moral indebtedness to Jews and Judaism, who know that their identity as Christians based on the Bible, their indebtedness to Jews, is profound and unchangeable, becomes all the more important in a world in which there are now forces, when a Farrakhan, who is not acting innocently out of theological speculation, but who comes to stand at the side of Jesse Jackson after having been 4 weeks before with Libya's Gaddafi, whom we know has given him $2.9 million for his propaganda in the United States. It is part of the mixing of religion and politics and ideology that now the Arab world has begun to understand that if they can use theological categories and frameworks to demoralize the Jews, delegitimize the Jewish people, delegitimize Judaism, and in the United Nations, delegitimize the State of Israel. And one of the ironies of our time, and it's difficult for us to understand this, at one time, Jews in the 40s and 50s had this utopic vision that the Marxist revolution was going to bring about the utopia. And the Jews became fellow travelers, and it was a classless society. There would be no distinction between men and women, Jews, Christians. That God has failed. But in those days, too, we believed that the Catholic Church was the worst enemy of the Jews, and for some dear good reasons. Catholics, Lutherans, Germany, they helped set the stage for the Nazis in terms of their imagery, their demonology. Today, the World Lutheran Federation has adopted a position after we met with them in Sweden in which they rejected all of the anti-Semitic teachings of Martin Luther and said we must come to the Jewish people in penitence, asking forgiveness for the hatred that we have caused against them, which has resulted in the destruction of so much of Jewish life. And what I'm saying now today, without wanting to overstate the reality, but our greatest allies in the world today and standing against anti-Semitism in all of its forms, especially its most demonological forms, the forms which the PLO and the Arab League and the Soviet Union are exploiting systematically, are people in the Catholic and in the mainline Protestant communities, in the evangelical churches, and in some parts of the Greek Orthodox community today. And it is not a luxury for us to understand that world and to relate to it. It is a matter of the most tough-nosed geopolitical response to what we're dealing with in this country. I don't want to take much more time on the details. I don't want to overstate the problems that I've not dealt with in their fullness in the time we have together. We have very real problems. There are issues in which I said before, selectively we can join together with the Roman Catholics, and there is great friendship for Jews on the part of many Roman Catholics, especially ethnics, who understand the old world. Italians and Irish, even some Germans, and Poles, with whom we built Polish-Jewish coalitions. We built coalitions with almost every ethnic group in the United States, including Hispanics now, to build that network of support, because the political support of America will depend on the public opinion support of the United States. And that must be continued to be strengthened. We have problems in the mainline Protestant groups. A leadership in the mainline Protestant group, which is third world oriented, to whom the heroes of the world are the Sandinistas and Cuba. And somehow when I found this past August, a year ago, when I was invited as the first Jewish speaker to address the World Council of Churches Assembly in Vancouver, 4,000 people all over the world, the Russian Orthodox delegation, not incidentally honeycombed with KGP agents. You saw all the galachim and the long garbs of men in gray suits following them around. They couldn't sit down and have lunch with anybody, including me, without a KGB agent present. But they begin adopting resolutions. They attack the United States on Central America. They attack the United States on Grenada. They attack the United States for South Africa. And then some galach cuts up from England and says, what about Afghanistan? Don't rock the boat. What about Poland? Don't rock the boat. See, in this sense, those who said at these political conventions that there are some liberals to whom Russia can do no wrong and the United States can do no right is accurate. There are some people who don't understand the peril in which constitutional democracies and human rights and civil and political liberties are under threat all over the world, and the importance of defending the strength of this country and the strength of Israel as among the foremost allies who uphold these basic liberties, not only for ourselves, but for all people who yearn for freedom and their human dignity and their fundamental human rights. And yet, what is interesting for us, as we have found out, is in the pews, the Peshitta dimension, the Presbyterians, the Episcopalians, the Baptists, and the churches who base it from Kunsen, from third world and cosmic geopolitics, who look at it, Jews, who see what Jews have suffered at the hands of Christians, who know the meaning of anti-Semitism, who've seen what the Klan has meant in this country and what American Nazis do and what the PLO is trying to do. Our polls show that even after the worst features in Lebanon, after a month settled down, 67% of the American people, including the liberal Protestants, supported Israel's security and Israel's welfare, and wanted the United States to continue its aid to Israel.